Here we go then, part 7, and I will share the screen and get the PowerPoint up if I can find it. It should be there. Okay, what's going on here? Oh, it's trying to pick up on everybody else's... Good grief, that's interesting. It's trying to pick up... Ah, he's got it now. Good, phew. I could have given you a very good presentation on the Nene Valley waterfowl, but probably not what we're actually looking for here. Here we go. Slideshow, play from start. Hurrah. Good. Well, hello and welcome. Here we are, part 7. And this is all about the 10 plagues, because the depth and richness in the story of the 10 plagues is extraordinary. And the whole of Exodus is like this, because it is... It's our own internal journey. If you think about it, probably we don't have the kind of extraordinary stuff that Moses had to go through. At least I hope we don't. But we'll get a challenge and we won't want to do it. And we'll try and turn back from it. And then we'll be pushed on to it. And we think, having got there to talk to Pharaoh, maybe it'll just all work out. And of course it doesn't. Because there's always more to do. And this is what happens with Moses. And even when he's got himself sorted out, he's then got to take the Hebrews with him and sort them out too. And the Hebrews in the desert represent all the aspects of our psyche that really, really don't want to play. At Tiferet, we can say, I need to do more exercise, shed some weight. But the ego and all the lower parts of the psyche just go, I'm going to forget about that. I don't want to do that. I want my pizza. I want my chocolate. And renege. And we start this reneging with the story of Moses and the Pharaoh, because you'll find out that Pharaoh agrees and then recants and agrees and then recants. And again, this is us. This is what we do. So let's just talk a little bit first about law, because we're going to get into the Exodus, and the Exodus is the giving of the law, and not only the Ten Commandments, but the start of the 613 laws of the Hebrew Testament as well. And people say, well, why is there so much law? And Christianity, of course, teaches that God is love. God is also law. God is universal law. The universe runs on law. It's mathematical. It runs on a system. The planets circle each other in the same way in each solar system. And the galaxies move round in their own particular ways according to law. That's the way it works. And karma or resonance is also law. That which is like unto itself is attracted. Somebody's not muted themselves. Would you be kind enough? I think it's probably Michelle having her supper. But anyway. So karma is law. We don't talk about it in Christianity, rarely talk about it in Judaism, but it's resonance. What you are resonates and draws to it something similar to that. So we don't really, if we fully understand that, need any other law, because we know what we put out we are going to get back. And I love that diagram of the man pushing down. It's effectively the domino system, isn't it? Once you push something, it continues round and round and round until it comes back and falls on you. And the ultimate law that Jesus said, and he did sum it up beautifully, which is to love the Lord thy God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might and all your mind and the person next to you as yourself. It's translated as neighbour, but it means anyone who may be next to you immediately. It doesn't mean necessarily the person that lives next door. And Deuteronomy has this exact phrase, except Jesus adds and all your mind to it. So Deuteronomy has all your heart, all your soul and all your might. And Jesus added all your mind, probably because he realized that you have to take charge of your mind in order to focus on loving God. And we have to also love the idea that although God is love, infinite compassion, and by some strange means that we can't possibly even conceive of, is in a personal relationship with every one of us, because God is in us, heart and soul. I'm just finishing off a book at the moment called Proof of Heaven by a neurosurgeon, an American, who was one of these people who was a brain surgeon, and knew pretty much everything science knows about what consciousness is. And consciousness is contained in the neocortex of the brain. And when people told him when they had brain tumours or nearly died or cardiac arrest or whatever, but particularly in his line of business in brain diseases, he always completely discounted near-death experiences because the neocortex was still existent, so therefore it could be the brain making it up. But he had bacterial meningitis, which is very, very, very rare, and 97% of people don't survive it. It makes you comatose, and if you're very lucky, multiple antibiotics will bring you round. But even if they do, more than 60% of the people are paralysed forever and possibly in a vegetative state. But this man had a near-death experience, even though it was technically impossible, and all the doctors were watching the medical, you know, all these beeping machines, and they could confirm that there was no consciousness there. But he went through. And he had a genuine near-death experience, and it came back and it changed him. And he came back also with this huge insight about the laws of the universe, and that all the laws are based on love, because they are teaching us always to be love, because if we are love, love will be reflected back to us. And the only reason why we need law is because we will not work with loving and trusting the divine and focusing that one on our neighbour. So the more laws we have is more indicative of how we don't want to trust God. We don't want to love God, and we don't want to trust God. And of course, that as a resonance is self-defeating. If you're afraid of God, you will create experiences around which your fear of God will grow. And translations such as "the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom," which is also in the Torah, when we don't realise that the word is actually awe. Awe is wonder and deep respect. It can include fear, but it's not primarily fear. And unfortunately, religion does tend to teach you to fear God rather than letting go and letting God and trusting the process of natural law to work out for us. And the thing is, we've got so immured in our problems, in the way we were raised by our parents and by our peers, and also the enlightenment, as it's called, the age of rationality. We get so rational, it's so hard for us to let go. And I learned quite recently that there's a vital difference between logic and rationality. Somebody who's being rational takes the outcome they believe in and then fills in the building blocks to prove it. And we have a modern world that is rational. Logical takes the building blocks and puts them together to find out what the outcome is. And in fact, we need a logical world to understand the Holy One and the whole of the universe. When we have a rational world, we start off with something like the case of the Supreme Court in America at the moment. They're working from the rationale that Christians don't have abortions, and working back down that to make sure that Christians don't have an abortion and therefore nobody else can have an abortion. Whereas the logical view of that would be, well, women are having abortions, so we can see that. So what are the building blocks as to why this is happening, and what can we do to build, to change the situation so fewer abortions are needed? So you can see that logic is actually far kinder than rationality, but we need law when we won't apply that simple logic. And I've used this picture before. This is the diagram of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. So Moses' journey is, we believe a physical journey may very well have happened, but it doesn't matter whether it did or not. Because one of my great teachers had a wonderful phrase, which I love, which is, "I don't know if it happened, and I don't know if it didn't happen, but I know that the story is true." Because this is a perennial story. And Moses' journey is a wonderful allegory for showing how our soul progresses and then is called back when outer obstacles and lower obstacles from within us fight it and pull it back. So it's an allegory for everybody, but it's also our own journey. And you'll recognise more and more as we get through this that, oh yes, that's what I did, or oh yes, that's what I do. And it's also an indication of the development of humanity. And in many ways, it's an indication of how very few of us really do want to do that work. Very, very few of us are willing to make a commitment to good, a commitment to kindness, a commitment to justice. And if we won't do that, then we need law, because without law, we will live in chaos. So the story itself. Moses has been told by God, Yahweh Elohim, to go back to Egypt, and that Pharaoh's heart will be hardened, so therefore the signs and wonders are going to have to happen. And we mentioned this last week, and we'll come back to it again, that God could only harden Pharaoh's heart because it was hard already. And usually in the fairy story, you only have to go back and do what you needed to do, and miraculously it all falls into place. But this is not what happens in real life. And we have the picture there of Aaron meeting Joseph, Aaron meeting Moses. That's from my childhood Ladybird book again. And we have here the Tree of Life, which has got the patriarchs on it. And these were put on it by Warren Kent and Zev Ben Shimon Halevi. And they start with David at Malkut. They don't follow chronologically. And Joseph at Yesod. We've already done Joseph. But Aaron is at Hod, and Moses is at Netzach, with Jacob at Tiferet. So Moses and Aaron are working together to try and lift themselves and the whole tribe up to Tiferet. And that is their job. And Aaron is at Hod because he's the communicator. Moses has said to the Holy One, I can't speak clearly, but Aaron could. And Moses is the initiator, and that's Netzach. And Pharaoh does get due warning. At the beginning of Exodus, God says to Moses, tell Pharaoh, and there's good old, Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner there from the Ten Commandments movie. This is what the Lord says, Israel is my son, my firstborn. It doesn't actually say son, it says my first child. It's translated and it has male verbs around it, so nowadays it is son, but it was my child. Israel is my firstborn. And if you remember, Jesus was also the firstborn. We're told only begotten with Jesus, but the only begotten is Adam Kadmon, which is the cosmic Christ, the upper world of Jacob's ladder, where all souls reside. All souls are born from there, and all souls eventually return to there. So we are all part of the firstborn of God. So, but Israel, and that, if you remember, means one who struggles with God, or one who is in communion with God, is the firstborn. And Moses is to say to Pharaoh, let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. So it's made clear to Pharaoh what the final criteria is. And again, why was Pharaoh's heart hardened? Well, it's resonance. If you harden your heart towards God, by nature of the Tree of Life, that black hole, Da'at, I've got my cursor on it now, as you can see it there, that's between Tiferet, the true self, and the divine, and you flow through that into the next world up. And if you are hard-hearted, you send that energy up. You continue to send it up, and by karma, by the law of resonance, that is what you will experience in return. So, in fact, spirit has very little choice but to supply you with whatever it is that you are already manifesting in thought, heart, and mind. Of course, there's karma and there's destiny and other things as well, and your astrology and your human design and all sorts of things play a part in this, and the plan before you came down. But basically, if you're hard-hearted, then the world will start showing you its hard heart as well. Also, it's said in the Bible that this is to show the power of the Lord. And in a way, that sounds really awful, but it's also true because the 10 plagues tell us how we get it wrong in our own lives. They are absolutely an internal journey. Each plague represents an aspect of our psyche and how that aspect of our psyche will affect our physical body in our health. And also, if we don't have to make the effort, if we don't have to be humbled in some way, if we continue with the arrogance of I can do it, I'm in control, I don't need to trust, then we couldn't learn the important lessons if everything just came to us that easily. Sometimes you look at somebody who seems to have an absolutely easy flowing life and you can envy them. But maybe they've got a holiday life because they've had such a difficult one previously. But in the end, the children of people who've had to struggle for their prosperity end up, this is a huge generality, but generality, but I have seen it and I've seen evidence of it and I've read quite a lot about it. Those who are born into affluence are generally not those who work for it. They don't understand the difficulties of life and they just expect everything to be handed them on a plate. Sometimes that works, but their children usually come quite a cropper from it. I mean, that's an old generalization, but the idea is that this story is here to teach us what we have to clear in ourselves. And neither our pride, that's negative to ferret, nor our ego, that's yesod, likes opposition. We want to be in our tribe. We want to have our place in our tribe. And Pharaoh says, quite understandably, because let's face it, we would if somebody turned up with a god from the people we had in slavery. And as Bill pointed out last session, those people could easily align with our enemy and overthrow us. Then we aren't going to want to listen to this strange new job God that says, let all these people go. Of course we're not. Who would? It's like somebody coming along to you and saying, there's a new boss of the company and from now on you have to go and work at a different desk. You will actually have to do it if you want to keep your job in that company, but you don't want to and you're going to fight that as much as you possibly can. So Pharaoh says, who is this Lord that I should obey him? I don't know the Lord and I will not let Israel go. I'm not changing. Everybody else has to change. I don't want to change. And that's primary negative Tiferet and negative Yesod, which is everybody else has to change. And we're seeing this again with the Supreme Court issue in America, which is that nobody's concerned about talking about how the justices could work on themselves or heal themselves, or no, right-wing America's saying those women who are pregnant must not have abortions. They need to change. We don't have to change, they do. And that's never, ever, ever going to work, and it's never going to bring you nearer the Holy One. So then Pharaoh gets furious about it all and makes the life for the Hebrews even harder as a kind of revenge. And Moses goes, Stercus, which is Latin, and I'm sure you know what it means, and goes back to talk to God in prayer and says, why have you brought trouble upon the people? You've made it worse. And of course, the Hebrews, who would have welcomed Moses back as a kind of saviour, I'm going to set you free, they're all furious with Moses, and Moses feels deeply humiliated because he hasn't managed to bring it off. And I'm sure you've experienced that as well. You say to a child, for example, I'll be home for your birthday party, or I'll get you this for Christmas, and you fail, and you just feel absolutely devastated. And the Hebrews were really, really angry with Moses. So Moses said to God, ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's brought trouble upon the people, and you haven't rescued us at all. You haven't done anything. You haven't done a thing. And this next bit in Exodus is interesting because it's one of those areas where the two texts have been joined up because we have the Lord and we have God. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, now you'll see what I'll do. And then it says, God also said to Moses. So they're, in a way, acknowledging these two great aspects of the Holy One, of Binah and Chokmah, which is the divine masculine and the feminine. And God, but God is saying, I too am the Lord. So it's also an attempt to show that these two are working together, which is so often forgotten. And it was God who appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob as El Hai Shaddai, El Shaddai, God Almighty. And that is a feminine noun. But by my name, the name you're calling me now, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. So basically, this is an attempt to show that it is the one God. It's just different aspects and different names of the one God. So both the Lord and God combine forces to say, okay, now we begin. Moses goes back to Pharaoh and with Aaron plays the tricks that God taught him. If you remember, there was the leprous hand and there was the casting down of the stave, the tree, the staff of sapphires to become a serpent. So Aaron does that to impress Pharaoh, and then Pharaoh calls his wise men and his magic makers and they can do exactly the same. However, Aaron's rods swallowed up their rods. Aaron's serpent ate their serpent. So they're showing that they can do magic. At the moment, all that's being demonstrated is that this is a higher magic, but it's still magic. Now, magic lives in Yetzirah, the tree of formation. And magic is very, very, very dangerous, because magic, as a Kabbalistic definition, is using my will. I want to make this happen. I want this person to love me. I want Pharaoh to let my people go. I think this is the right thing that should happen. I think this person should heal. So we can do magical practices, but when you do that, because Yetzirah is the watery world of formation, what you're doing is you're putting it out of kilter and it will always snap back. So whenever somebody does magic, eventually the magic comes round karmically and bites them. It will always happen that way. Miracles, spiritual intervention, comes from Berea, comes from Atzilut down into Berea, and it's what is for the highest good of all. That is not magic. That is alignment to the Holy One's will. So we'll be talking both magic and spirit here, but the 10 plagues work at different levels. Let's get to that. Right, Moses and Aaron ask Pharaoh three times to let the Israelites go, but they're not going to. And the first plague, we'll talk about the plagues themselves in a minute, Aaron and Moses invoke this first one, the changing of the water of the Nile into blood, or at least to make it scarlet. And if you remember from last session, God had said one of the signs that they would do would be to take water and put it on land where it would become blood. So Moses and Aaron do this. Moses gets Aaron to stretch out the staff over the Nile and does an incantation, and the water turns into blood for 7 days, which means nobody has anything to drink. However, after the 7 days, Pharaoh's magicians turn out they can do exactly the same. So nobody's terribly impressed because it's still purely magical. The three plagues after that are also done by Aaron, Moses' advice, and these are plagues of earth and water. The first one is a plague of water, and the next ones are earth and water, as in that frogs come out of the water, lice are physical, bite people, and swarms. Usually this is translated as flies, but it could also be wild animals. It can be 500 wild goats pouring in or something like that, but it's too much of something, way too much of something. And then the third three, which is the afflicted cattle, the boils and the hail, those are just Moses. And these are air and fire. These are the ones that are much more powerful. They include the death of the cattle, which means the taking out of the food, and boils, which are The build-up of anger and hatred at Gevurah and Hail, of course, is ice that comes down and burns. And the last three, which are the locust, the darkness and death, come directly from the Holy One. So the first ones are manifested. Okay, God gives them the power, but they are manifested through Aaron and through Moses. But the last three come as a higher order entirely. There are no plagues at all in the Hebrew area, which was Goshen. No plagues at all. And it's only the last plague that they have to protect themselves from. It just affects the Egyptians. So the first one is the changing of the water of the Nile into blood, which lasts 7 days. So we know perfectly well that something like that can happen anyway. You can get a runoff of copper into water that changes the colour. So everybody's going, yeah, it was horrible, but it didn't last that long and we're all okay now. And then the frogs come out. They come bouncing out of the Nile and go everywhere and get everywhere. And they're just inconvenient. They're not poisonous, but they're very inconvenient. And Pharaoh says, well, OK, go sacrifice to your God and I'll consider letting you go. But then the magician's replicated again and he goes, well, no, then I won't. And we can see this in us, which is, OK, something's going on in my body. I don't like it. I tell you what, I'll do a cleanse for a couple of weeks. I feel better now. Okay, we'll forget about it. Goodness me, I've been there. So nobody really worries about it. And it's okay, I've done what I could. That's all I needed to do. Everything's okay now. Second plague is lice, which is basically fleas biting you all over, biting into your blood. But Pharaoh's, it doesn't last very long. And again, Pharaoh says, nope, no deal. That's not that bad. We got over it. No, shan't. Then the swarms, which is the place is overrun. And let's say it was flies, because that would be really unpleasant and really unhygienic. And if it was something like tsetse flies, it could bring serious, serious disease. So Pharaoh says, okay, yes, I will let you go. And then as soon as the swarms have gone, he recants and says no. So you can see it's getting a little bit worse each time. And every time Pharaoh's sort of going, well, okay, no, it's all right now. And we do this all the time. We all do this all the time. Next one is cattle. Their food dies. I think it's the eldest of the cattle. I think it's the firstborn of all the cattle that dies. Forgive me, I can't remember that bit actually. I should have looked that up again today, but I didn't. Anyway, cattle is dying right, left and centre, but they're going to go, oh, well, never mind, it's not all dead. And anyway, we've got the food in the fields, and Pharaoh's getting pretty knocked by that. So he goes, no. Next one is boils. People come out in boils. And again, Pharaoh says no, because these are something that people generally recover from. Then there's hail, great big clumps of ice, and that takes down the crops. So they've lost the cattle, or most of the cattle, or enough of the cattle for it to be a problem, but it wouldn't have been a problem if they kept the crops, but now the crops have been destroyed. So again, Pharaoh says, okay, deal, and then changes his mind again. Because the hail stops and it turns out it wasn't quite as bad as he thought it was. So no, you can't. Then we get the three plagues from God, which is the locusts. And the locusts come in and eat everything. They eat everything that was already flattened by the hail. They eat the fruit. They just swarm and destroy. You know what locusts are like. And Pharaoh begs Moses to stop this, but still doesn't give Moses the yes he wants. In fact, he drives Moses out of his consciousness. And this is something that we also do, which is going to huge denial, which is the person who is bringing the plagues is in my presence. Therefore, if I get rid of them, everything else will go. And we see this with surgery, certainly. If we have a diagnosis of cancer, we'll have the tumour removed. And then, because it's out of our consciousness, we'll go back to our everyday life, and without realising that perhaps there's going to be metastasis coming along and there's more than we need to do. So it's a very easy thing to do, to say, OK, we've cut that out now. It's all right. We can go back to where we were. The next one is darkness. which means basically probably dust storms over the sun in a practical way, but or the sun doesn't rise. And of course, Pharaoh's job was to make the sun rise every day. And I don't know whether in this era they did that, but in many of the Egyptian eras, Pharaoh had to do prayers in the morning without which the sun would not rise. Now, of course, we know that that's rubbish, but they truly believed that. And there are still convents and monasteries worldwide, very few of them now, the enclosed ones, where they get up before dawn and sing the day in. They sing Lords. They sing this beautiful series of prayers, and the sun rises while they do it. So it's same thing in a different way. In a way, it's honouring the sunrise. But the Egyptians actually believed that Pharaoh made the sunrise. So this one is making Pharaoh lose face. That's important. And he recants, and then he threatens to kill people. Once the sun comes back, having said, yes, you can go, then he goes, I've changed my mind. I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to kill your people. And then the death of the firstborn. So Passover is the Jewish feast which celebrates the escape of the Hebrew people from the death of the firstborn and the exodus from Egypt. And it takes place in the first month of the Jewish year, which is Nisan, 10 days in. Now, the Jewish calendar is a moon-based calendar. We have a sun-based calendar, and so did the Essenes, oddly enough, when Jesus was alive. But Judaism has always had a moon-based calendar. So 10 days in should be the full moon. And that's an important time of power. And so their belief would be that the Passover happened at the time of the full moon. And the Hebrews were told to get a lamb without blemish. And this is a lamb of sacrifice. And if you know the Christian scriptures, you know that Jesus is the Lamb of God, and he's the shepherd, and speaks of the lamb. And at Revelation, it's the lamb, the innocent lamb, who is the saviour. But so they were told, they were given an advance warning of this, to get an unblemished lamb and to keep it for 4 days. 4 days represents the four worlds. Four is always an act of completion. 10 days in, 10 Sephirot, 4 days, 4 worlds. And what's important about this that nobody seems to see is that if you've got a lamb in the house for 4 days, you're going to get fond of it. You're going to understand exactly what it means to kill something you love. So even the Hebrews had some idea of what the Egyptians were going to go through. Certainly the children were taught the pain of losing something, the pain of sacrifice. And this is part of one of the reasons why the Hebrews were in the desert for 40 years, 4-0 again, 4-10s, a full cleansing of a generation before they could get to the promised land. But the children were taught, even before they left Egypt, that freedom comes at a price. There is sacrifice. It doesn't have to be physical sacrifice. It may be emotional or mental sacrifice, but sacrifice, the making sacred of something and the giving something up, is really important in spiritual work. So the children would have been fond of the lamb, and then the lamb was killed. The blood of the lamb was smeared on the door with a particular herb that was in the instruction, hyssop. And that's an antioxidant. That is a herb that would actually stop any flies getting on that blood and tainting it. So if a child put a finger on that wall and then put it to its mouth, it wouldn't get any kind of poisoning or anything like that. So we don't realise how important the herbal law is in the Bible, but hyssop would have been the perfect herb for putting the blood around the wall, because it would keep the blood pure. The lamb was then roasted with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and it was unleavened simply because it was made swiftly. It had the raising agents in it, it just didn't have time to rise. And they were told to eat with their loins girded, i.e. fully dressed, with shoes or sandals on their feet, a staff in their hand, and eat it swiftly, because once the plague came, then they were going to have to jump to it and go. And a lot of that is still honoured today. The Passover feast it's very special. It's got bitter herbs, it's got horseradish, it's got ceremony. A lot of people do it without spiritual knowledge, but hopefully one day we'll all be able to get together and do a Kabbalistic Seder together, which would be lovely. So back to these 10 plagues again. Let's look at the symbolism of them. The first one is blood, and that represents the vital force of our life's blood, the body itself and our values. Frogs at Yesod, well, frogs puff themselves up, so they also represent the overinflated ego. And also because they're amphibious, they can go in water and out of water. So they can think they're superior. You know, I can go on the land, I can go in the water. I'm in charge here, I've got control. And Yesod likes that very much. Hod, lice or paradise, they steal lifeblood without offering anything in return. And you can see that happening in social media. You can see that happening a lot in the world, which is the vampire aspect, the people who live off the energy of others. You see it, the very wealthy live off the energy of others. They live off the energy of the people who are doing the work. And if they give back, then that's absolutely fine. But it's an unhealthy aspect of life when you do steal the lifeblood without giving anything in return. And a lot of us do that, obviously. Netzach, which is the swarms, those are our animal drives. And the commandment that prohibits adultery, okay, we hadn't got it then, but it's all of a piece. That's the misuse of those drives. If you think about the idea that it was a swarm of flies or maybe a swarm of animals, it's us all heading hell-pent for that extra pizza. You know, I'm just going to have another pizza. I'm going to get a takeaway. I'm going to do the easiest possible thing, whether it adulterates my body or not. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to overdo it. I'm going to drink too much. I'm going to do too much. I'm going to say too much. And then at Tiferet, we have the pestilence of the cattle, which is a direct attack on the body in order to try and release its hold on the psyche. Because our bodies do hold our psyches. We've learned over the years, and the more rational we get, the more we believe in the physical, and the body is everything. The physical life is everything, and it will tell us when it wants to eat. It'll tell us what it wants to do. It'll tell us it wants to have sex. And if it rules us, then we cannot get to Tiferet. We cannot get to God for our salvation. We can't get to the area where the good intuition is going to come down to us. So the afflicted cattle is an attempt to get us to say, okay, the body is failing, there has to be more than this. Boils at Gevura, boils are nearly always anger. They're the swelling up of unexpressed anger. And so you can see that that would move over to an explosive outpouring. So the inbuilt anger and resentment eventually will crack. And that's where we get to hail, which is the hesed, which is that the tantrum the child has, or the time where you just literally can't handle it anymore and have an outburst at work, which probably gets you fired. And it's also worth looking at the side triads here, because the left-hand side triad, which is Gevura, Tiferet, Hod, is where we store emotional pain, guilt, grief. And a healthy left-hand side triad will hold sorrow, the sorrow of the world and the sorrow of loss, but it's not harmful. Sometimes this parting is such sweet sorrow, as Shakespeare wrote in Romeo and Juliet. That side is always going to have aspects of pain, but it's worth it if you're balanced. It's like when your pet dies, it's terrible, but you had the pet. You had those years. You've got the memories. You've got the love still there. It's not a popular triad at all. The other triad on the other hand, is very popular because that's the triad of excess and addiction. So the left-hand triad basically is no, this is over. And the right-hand triad is yes, more, 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 more. And the left-hand triad goes rotten where we wallow in our pain, when we take our wound as our identity and we use it for power. You can see this quite often. I know somebody whose daughter died very, very young. And she, that's a total tragedy. I mean, goodness, yes. But she refuses to get beyond it. She uses it as a weapon. If you try to get her to do anything she doesn't want to do, she will say, I'm not feeling good enough. I'm really grieving for my daughter today. I can't do it. Instead of being able to say, no, I don't want to. So that side can be very unhealthy when we hold on to our pain. And it's also where the pain we don't even know is there, is there. Fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, all those difficult to diagnose but totally genuine illnesses which are epidemic in our world today are placed in that triad, and they are all coming from a place of self-hatred. And the other triad is the triad of addictions, of more, 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 more of what doesn't work. So it's excess, anything we can possibly do to transfer our pain somewhere else. You know, we'll just get onto the TV and start watching stuff. We won't deal with the pain, we'll mask it. But we will, what is it that 12 Steps says? Addiction is more and more of what does not work. Because if it did work, you wouldn't need more and more of it. And then the locust, well, that's Bina, which is the place of understanding. And it's about starving yourself of understanding. The locusts will just say, well, be rational about it. Well, this is this, so I don't need to understand it. That's the way it is. That's exactly the way it is. And you starve yourself from possibilities of other aspects. So if you discard anything but the law, and Binah is law, it's the rule by Saturn, which is the planet of tradition and law. So Binah is about, a good Binah is understanding that things change, that the one constant in the universe, the one unchanging thing is that things will change. And if you can't allow that, then you're going to get eaten up by those locusts. And Chokmah, well, spiritual darkness is the inability to see clearly. Again, it's the rational thing. I have the outcome in front of me in my mind, therefore nothing else needs to come in. Nothing's going to change my view of that. I'm going to put the pieces together to prove myself right. And a negative Chokmah will completely refuse to allow intuition or inspiration to come in. And that is spiritual darkness. And finally, the death of the firstborn. Well, the firstborn is our deepest, most carefully guarded patterns and habits. So the firstborn is how we were trained to believe everything as a child. And all of these basically have to be knocked on their head. So the first beliefs, it's this idea of Jesus saying, who are my parents? These people here are my parents, my family. My physical family is not my family. And one of the first things we learn is the importance of family and tribe. And this is the final death knell to that, which is no, it's not like that at all. So if you look at the plagues in the body, actually in the body itself, you can see that the first one, well, it's water to blood. So physically, it's going to be a wound or a blood pressure incident, but it basically comes from thoughts that are poisoned, because thoughts and emotions in Yetzirah are fluid. And if our thoughts are poisonous, constantly negative, constantly angry, constantly resentful, then we will poison our blood. That's the way it goes. We will raise our blood pressure and we will start send messages round in the blood and the lymph, which of course they didn't know about then, but the lymph and the blood work together. If you consistently, as I did, say, believe that you are not protected, not only will you create a world where you are not protected, but you will give a message to your blood and your lymphatic system that you are not protected, and then something like a lymphoma is very likely to manifest eventually because your body believes you. I'm not protected. Okay, the lymph won't work then. The second one is frogs jumping up, bouncing out, swelling up. So it's in swellings or inflammation, if you like. It's the level of the stomach. inside us. So it's going to be something to do with how we digest things, whether we are able to digest a variety of things or whether we stick to exactly the same food. I've got a comedian colleague who has irritable bowel syndrome and takes all sorts of medications for it. But she's still going out and having McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken. She just ups her medication. It has not occurred to her that she needs to change her mind and look at her diet. It simply wouldn't occur to her. She's just not got that consciousness level. So that's the yesodic one. 3, skin rashes, irritations, fever. So you can see how this might work. You're starting off with high blood pressure, then you're going to start getting indigestion. You're still not dealing with the underlying problem, whatever it is. So then your skin starts to get a little bit uncomfortable or itchy. Most dermatology nowadays knows that it starts in the gut. It's something to do with your diet, but the skin rashes and the irritations and the fever are the next sign that things are starting to get sort of important here. There's something you need to deal with. And then we go across to the flies, which is discharges, swarms, being sick, the blood pressure going up again, something going septic, something going racing, getting heart palpitations, something that is... the issue of blood, the woman who touched Jesus's robe, when your periods go wrong, if you're a woman, or whether your prostate isn't working properly. It's going to be something about the expelling or the not expelling or the not processing things. And it can also be a mania, which is panic, I'm getting obsessed with things, because remember, this is the side on the right hand side of addiction. Then to 4, we're going to get more serious discharges. We will have had irritations and fever. But once we get to ferret, we're actually going to get the possibility of mania, because we're going to be right in the centre of Yetzira, in charge of the physical, but we're out of control. So we can get to the point where we become obsessed about things. And the people who get to be, I don't know, 1,000 pounds, or I don't know if you can get to be that big, these vastly huge people. I've got this problem here with the afflicted cattle, because they have a huge inner need to be manic about their eating. They can't stop it. They're caught between these two side triads. And they're going to get all forms of discharges, just everything else ramped up a little bit more, in a way that the body says, I really can't cope with this anymore. And you go slightly bonkers with it. And if you've ever been in huge pain, you'll know it affects your mind. If you've got backache, you're irritable. If you've got something really seriously wrong with you, you're more than irritable. You may be weeping or upset, but you really won't tolerate very much from other people, because you get right inside yourself and you get obsessed with this pain. Next one is the boils. Well, that's when, once it gets above Tiferet, you really are in trouble, because boils are organ damage. This is diabetes. This is where the body has to bring up the inflammation in a way that really shows. And of course, this is going to be the start of a cancer, the first tumour. It's going to be absolutely, everything has got to the point where the body can't cope. So it's going to pick it up and put it in a lump and try and hide it. And that's basically what the body does with the cancer. It picks up all this negativity and pain and grief and pollution and puts it in a lump to try and hide it. And I had when I sold one of my houses, it was bought by a pathologist, and we had a lovely long conversation, during which he said he had never cut open the body of a human over the age of 50 without finding at least one encapsulated cancer. Usually they were tiny, perhaps the size of a ball bearing, perhaps the size of a marble, but a cancer had been built in the body, and then it had been sealed off by the body, and it could remain there until something else triggered it. And he said, in his view, I'm not saying it's my view, but it sounds logical to me, that one of the worst things you can do with an encapsulated cancer, if it's stable, is to cut it out. Because if you cut it out, you may activate it and make it metastase by, you know, just catching a bit of it or something like that. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but that was, you know, a pathologist's view. And certainly, if you have the primary tumour taken out, you may very well survive and it may not come back, but it will not come back if you change something. If you change something else. And that's Gavura, which is the discipline to change your life. Over to Hale, well, that's hundreds of lumps, isn't it? So that's the metastasis. That's when the cancer spreads throughout your body. And from that point, there has to be a big intervention, whether it's medical or spiritual. I think it's Caroline Mace who says causes of all illnesses are primarily psychological. Now, of course, there's pollution in the environment as well, but the psyche, why is the psyche in that environment? She says all causes of physical disease is emotional or psychological, but all cures come from spirit. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it's a very powerful statement. And certainly with cancer, if you want to fully recover forever, you have to change something quite dramatic. So the Hale is the metastasis. Then we go to Locus, which is Binar, which is you are on the way to dying now. And when you are seriously ill, you lose interest in eating. Or even if you are eating, the disease eats the food, not you. You can eat your head off if you're very ill with cancer, but the cancer will eat it before it gets to your digestive system. It will be diverted to the disease. So that's locusts perfectly. Darkness is when you are close to death and you go into a different experience. When you sit with somebody who's dying, they do go into darkness. Sight fades. We do die in this order, in that we stop eating and then we stop seeing, and then we last thing is we stop hearing, oddly enough. But the darkness is a sign that death is on its way. And then finally, at Keter, if all the rest of that has not been resolved in any way, shape or form, that's death. So that's why the death of the firstborn is not only a story about escalating to get Pharaoh's resistant over it, it's a story of what goes on inside all of us. And if we will not surrender to the Holy One and learn and listen and be willing to change our life, then we will go through this process in some way, shape or form. So the Israelites kill their lamb, put the blood around the lintel of the door with the hyssop, and stay inside, eat their feast and wait in silence with all the windows shut. And there arises this great wail of grief, because in every house the eldest dies, the firstborn dies, including Pharaoh's son. So he calls for Moses and Aaron and says, go out, get away, go, go, go. I mean, this is not a, yes, you may go. It's get everybody out of my sight. Get, go, go, go. Take your flocks, take your herbs, just take your herds, not herbs. Just get out of here. Go, go. Because it's just too terrible. It's over. And the Egyptians give the Hebrews gold, silver and clothes. Just go, go. You know, if you need it, go. Just throw everything at them. And the children of Israel leave, including a mixed multitude going with them. So it wasn't just the Hebrews. They took people of other tribes with them, which is very interesting. But they journeyed from the great capital city of Ramses to Sukkot, and there were 600,000 of them, so it says. I don't know if it was that many, but my goodness, that's just the humans on foot plus the children. When it says men, it means men and women. It's, the Bible's a bit like that. So they were a vast, vast amount of people heading out for this wilderness. And of course, once they've gone, Pharaoh's going to change his mind again and want them back. But next week, that's where we get to that on the next week. But this is the start of the journey. At some point in our life, before we've got to the death of the firstborn, to the death, At some point, we have to get up and take that journey if we want to heal. And we may do it through a divorce. We may do it by changing our job. It doesn't have to be a vastly huge thing. But for the spiritual seeker, there is always the dark night of the soul, which is the plagues, and the decision to change, to get up, to move on and make things differently. And that's when the real work begins. So I forgot to stop in the middle of that. I'm sorry for questions. Sorry, Elise. Anyway, anybody got anything they want to ask or say or point out? No? Yes, Bill. Don't forget to unmute, Bill.
It's a minor point. You're mentioning about the Jewish calendar being a lunar calendar. This is not quite true. It's a Muslim calendar. It's a lunar calendar.
It's a Jewish one, not anymore. It was back in the biblical days.
No,
I was completely wrong. I apologise.
So right, it's a lunar solar calendar.
Right.
And it works on a 17-year cycle. And every now and then, I think about every 3 or 4 months, an extra month is put in to get it right with the sun.
So it's lunar and solar, right? Oh, well, that's really interesting, Bill. Thank you.
And over a 17-year period, it always comes right with the sun, whereas the Muslim calendar romps steadily through the year, so that 1 year, Ramadan, the great fast, is in the winter and is bearable, and a few years later, it's the middle of summer and is unbearable.
Yes. Because you can't eat between dawn and dusk, so 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. Geez, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Bill, that's great. Thank you very much indeed. Anybody else? Anything? No? Can you see, though, how much the plagues are important to us and how it's psychological as well as spiritual? This is an extraordinary book, Exodus. It really is. Okay, I'll stop the recording then. Thank you.